Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to all the men and women who have served and are currently serving in defense of our nation throughout the world.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
I'm Bob Gould. I'm going to be your host today on Veterans Radio. And with me today on the board is Dale Throneberry. Dale, how you doing?
Welcome to Veterans Radio. And today's program, I think, is going to be pretty exciting. We're anxious to get our guests on the air as soon as we can. And we're just going to have to fill right here. Actually, I'll tell you what we're going to do, Bob. We're going to take a quick break here, and we're going to go right to Marine Scholars and see if that's working right now.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now, we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Okay, well, anyway, the Gremlins. Could be because it's the Ohio State, Michigan program today. Maybe it's some of those guys from Ohio. Nah, can't be. Well, this is Bob Gould, and I have Dale Throneberry running the board. Well, and plus we have the chief.
Yeah, you think I might be running the board.
I know. We got the chief engineer here. We couldn't have been any luckier. Let's just go right into our first guest, Dale. Okay. Our first guest is Bob Dorr, an author. He served in the U.S. Air Force from Korea. He also has 24 years as a Foreign Service officer. His tours of duty have included Madagascar, Seoul, South Korea, Japan, Liberia, London, Stockholm. He contributes to articles to the Air Force Monthly and Air and Space Flight Journal, a weekly opinion column in the Air Force Times. He also writes weekly history columns for the Military Times newspaper. He's been interviewed by several networks, including C-SPAN, Discovery Channel, CNN, and local Washington area newscasts. He's written a couple of books here, Mission to Berlin, which we had. We had Bob talking about that recently, and Hell Hawks. Bob, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good morning.
Well, I'm sure that those things happen every now and then. How do you find time to do anything with all that writing that you do?
I get up at 4 a.m. and go to bed at 8:30 p.m., and I don't do anything else, and I have no life. But I take it you're having glitches this morning, and that reminds me of the engines on the B-29 bomber, which had glitches all the time.
Well, they call that the segue. What a segue. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, Bob?
The B-29 bomber was the most extraordinary aircraft in the world at the time that it came into existence. It was the first bomber to be fully pressurized so that the crew could fly at high altitude in their shirt sleeves. It was bigger and heavier and faster and longer range than any other bomber in the world. It also looked kind of neat. Another writer pointed out that it looked like it was designed by the designer Raymond Loewy, who also designed the Studebaker Avante, among other things. The only trouble is the engines never worked very well.
Oh, that's nice.
And I'm not enough of a mechanical expert to give you all the details, but throughout the whole career of the B-29, engine fires were always a problem.
Well, they needed a long-range bomber. They had to reach Japan. They obviously couldn't use the B-24, B-26, B-25, or B-17s without getting real bloody close. So the B-29 was on the design boards. When did that first come into production?
In 1942, and it was rushed into production, perhaps a little hastily, early in the service life of the B-29, we had a bunch of airplanes in Kansas getting ready to go to war, and they had so many mechanical problems that General Henry H. Hap Arnold, the commanding general of the Army Air Forces, had to fly out to Kansas and stir up some activity to get people to get the B-29s fixed and get them working right and get them out to India and later to the Pacific, to the Marianas.
Well, when they designed that B-29, was it for the purpose for heavy bombing? Was it going to be a low altitude or high altitude bomber?
It was designed in consistent with our bombing practice at the time to be a high-altitude precision bomber. At the time, we didn't know yet very much about the jet stream, the very high-velocity winds at high altitude that B-29 crews encountered over Japan. And that was one of the factors that prevented high-altitude bombing from working very well over Japan.
Now, Curtis LeMay, General LeMay, he doesn't like to use the word raid. He likes to use the word mission. There were no raids. This was a war going on, and each one was its own separate battle. So, when did he come on as what would you call him? The chairman of the Air Force, or when he was in charge of the whole bombing campaign? When did he come on?
LeMay began his wartime career as a squadron and group commander of B-17s in Europe, but he was picked by Arnold to come to India and later to the Pacific to be in charge of the B-29 force, and he was made the commander of 21st Bomber Command, which was part of the 20th Air Force, which was commanded directly from by Arnold, directly from Washington, from a new building called the Pentagon.
Well, at that point, what did he bring to the table?
Initially, nothing new. His predecessor, Haywood Hansell, had been directing high-altitude bombing of Japan, and initially LeMay did the same thing. But LeMay was someone who could quickly make changes, and when he realized that they just weren't hitting anything from high altitude and that the bombing wasn't being terribly effective, he made the decision to begin sending large numbers of B-29s over Japan at very low altitude, at altitudes as low as 5,000 feet. And he did this for the first time in the great firebomb mission to Tokyo on the night of March 9th and 10th of 1945.
Now, when we started to bomb Japan, that began, of course, with the raid by Doolittle, but it was mostly a public relations event. A good thing to get the morale of America back up after getting our fanny slammed there during December 7th. When was the next time, the next raid, or the next missions, the next missions that started to bomb Japan, the mainland?
Well, B-29 bombers were initially based in India and flew bombing missions by shuttling to China first and then flying from China to Japan, and that began in the fall of 1944.
So
and initially, the missions over Japan were flown by relatively small numbers of bombers, and then the force grew, and around the end of 1944, we began having B-29s stationed on the three islands in the Marianas from which they flew throughout most of 1945. That would be Guam, Saipan, and Tinian.
So they were bombing Japan at that time. Were they very successful with their targets?
They were not succeeding until LeMay made the very difficult decision to send the bombers in at very low altitude beginning on March 9th of 1945, and then after that, and also made the decision to make greater use of incendiary bombs, fire bombs, against a society that lived in buildings that were made of wood and paper.
Oh, that's about it. Right. And you have this campaign starting, and they really wanted to burn Japan. They wanted to level the place with incendiary bombs. So when they did that, what was the success rate of that? Now at that point, what was the success rate?
Well, the first major mission, the March 9th mission, was the most destructive air attack in the history of the world. It leveled about 16 square miles of central downtown Tokyo. Estimates of the number of people killed go up to 140,000. A great deal of Japan relied, the Japanese war machine relied on home-based small industries to build war supplies, and a lot of that was destroyed in that mission. Again, it was more destructive than both of the later atomic bombs put together.
I know a lot of folks don't know that. They think
it caused the hottest fires that ever burned on the earth.
And
quite a contrast, by the way, to the war in Europe, which is covered in my book, Mission to Berlin.
I like that segue. That's right, the Mission to Berlin, which we covered a couple of weeks ago on our program. But your other book that's in progress, folks, it's in progress, Mission to Tokyo. Tell us a little bit about
indeed,
that.
Indeed, and with a great deal of good luck and hard work, we'll have it finished shortly, and it'll be published in the middle of next year.
Well, tell us about the missions to Tokyo.
It was a little disorienting to the crews because a typical mission began with a takeoff at 6:30 or 7 o'clock in the evening, which meant that you typically spent an entire day sort of being nervous and getting briefed and being ready to go and not having enough to do to keep you from thinking about what was coming next. And you would take off at about 6:30 p.m. and you would fly to your target in Japan, and you would arrive there typically shortly after midnight. And face Japanese searchlights and any aircraft guns and night fighters. And if all went well, you would return to your home base on Guam, Saipan, or Tinian at about 6 or 7 o'clock the following morning.
So it was almost a 24-hour mission.
Mm-hmm.
And how long was this campaign to Tokyo? I know a lot of folks don't know that, about the missions and going to Tokyo. How long was that campaign in effect?
Well, we had flown missions to Tokyo beginning in the fall of 1944, but we really were not being very effective until March of 1945, and then, of course, the bombing continued until the end of the war on August 15th.
So that looks like we had a couple of years that we were actually bombing Tokyo.
It's actually about 1 year.
Okay. And
the fall of 1944 until August of 1945.
Okay. Now, we're now going to Tokyo. I know that that's where the emperor had his. Was there anything that was specific to protect the emperor? I know they didn't. That was off limits. So, was there anything specific that was done by the bombardiers when it comes to not bombing the Imperial Palace?
Well, it is true indeed that the American side established a policy that the Imperial Palace would be off limits, and this was one of the things that happens in war that apparently went right, because throughout the war we never did drop a bomb on the Imperial Palace.
That's just amazing. That's absolutely amazing. I mean, was he? No, he couldn't have been warned. No. I know.
Completely devastated the area nearby.
Nearby, and you would think though that would start to bring Japan to think, hey, what are we doing here? Why are we fighting these guys anymore? They're able now to come in to our capital. So politically,
I haven't been able to find very many people who think that the Japanese were thinking that way at that point. I think the leadership still believed that there was some way that they could work out some kind of agreement that would allow them to keep some of their wartime conquests. And the people were being told what the leadership wanted them to hear, and they were observing B-29s that were initially being pretty ineffective in trying to bomb them.
Right, but
so I don't think the Japanese were saying to themselves, it's all over, we'd better quit now. Although I think that if we had been willing to negotiate something, we might have been able to end the war sooner. The decision the decision that caused the greatest loss of life in the history of the world was the Allied decision to insist on unconditional surrender.
That's what made
the war last much longer than it needed to.
Ooh, that's interesting. Well, but otherwise, though, there would have been certain territories that would have stayed with Japan, and well, who knows at that point? And what happened on December 7th, I guess, had to be avenged.
That was the position that Franklin D. Roosevelt took, and he was the architect of the unconditional surrender policy, and that was the way it unfolded.
And who was his Secretary of State? Was that Hull?
Yeah, I have a mental blank on that at the moment, and I used to work for the State Department, so don't tell them, but I think Cordell Hull was gone by then.
Okay, now
Roosevelt pretty much made his own foreign policy.
Wow. So he was on top of this. He was on top of it.
Very much.
I want to get back, though, to bombing of Tokyo. Did the American public know at that time, before we dropped the atomic bombs, how much we were attacking Tokyo?
I don't think it was coming to the attention of people very much. It was certainly public knowledge that the B-29s were bombing Japan regularly, not only Tokyo, but dozens of other large and medium-sized cities. But I think it was just accepted by the public as being a natural part of the war, along with other aspects of the war that were unfolding at the same time.
When we're bombing Japan like we were bombing, I know in reading some of your books that we lost 10,000 B-17s. That's a lot. And what was the attrition rate on the B-29?
Well, we lost 10,000 four-engine bombers in the war, some of which were B-17s, and there's a lot about that in my book, Mission to Berlin. the losses in the B-29 force were actually comparatively small when you consider the magnitude of what they were doing and how they were doing it. We lost a few hundred of the 4,000 B-29s that were built in the campaign against Japan. About one-third of those were lost to enemy action, and the other two-thirds were primarily the result of mechanical problems that were never really solved.
Well, with that, so essentially it was a quote-unquote safer missions to be going to Tokyo.
Yes, it was, although that obviously means no disrespect to the men who did it. They realized themselves that, thank goodness, they didn't have to wear oxygen masks. They didn't have to wear heated clothing. They weren't cold. They weren't being bounced around. And the opposition that they faced was significant, but it wasn't the same as in Europe.
Bob, we just have about 2 minutes to go in this segment, and I know Christmas time is coming up. I want to give you an opportunity to talk about your books, Hellhawks and Mission to Berlin. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
I'm going to mention my phone number in a second. My two current World War II books make very good gifts for the holidays. Hellhawks is a history of a P-47 Thunderbolt fighter group in combat in Europe, on the ground in Europe in World War II. It's been called a companion to Band of Brothers because it's really very largely about the ground war in Europe and the role of P-47s in that war, Hellhawks. My newest book is called Mission to Berlin. It's about B-17 Flying Fortress crews in the war in Europe. And my books are available all over the place, but I would love to hear from any Veterans Radio listeners who would like to call me on the phone.
Oh, give us that.
My phone number is 703-264-8950. If you lose that, just Google Robert F. Dorr, D-O-R-R.
And can they buy it? Can they buy it on a website, or do they have to call you?
Well, they can, but I want, yes, this is a real book. They can buy it in all of the obvious places, but I'm hoping that some listeners to this radio broadcast will contact me directly.
Okay. Once again, folks, that phone number, 703-264-8950, 703-264-8950. 50. Well, our time is up for this segment. Bob Dorr, thank you very much for being on our program. Thank you for your patience in the beginning. We had a little problem, but we finally got this back on the air. And I want to thank you again for being, and we'll look forward to having you on the program again.
Thank you, Bob and Dale.
Well, Dale, how are we doing there, buddy? All right, we'll be right back.
Well, we hope everything will work.
Yeah, we'll be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Seaman John Catherwood defended his leader even though he could not stand. Detail after this.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife. My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
While attached to the USS Pam Pang, Catherwood was one of a shore party moving in to capture Mundang on the Philippine Islands on the morning of 24 September 1911. Advancing with a scout party to reconnoiter a group of huts close to the trail, Catherwood unhesitatingly entered the open area before the huts, where his party was suddenly taken under point-blank fire and charged by approximately 20 enemy coming out of the native huts and from other concealed positions. Struck down almost instantly by the outlaws' deadly fire, Catherwood, although unable to rise, rallied to the defense of his leader and fought desperately to beat off the hostile attack.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Okay, folks, well, Christmas again is coming up. And if you want the best in U.S. military apparel, then you're going to want to go on the website for U.S. Wings. That's U.S. Wings. And everything is manufactured right here in good old America. And it is it's quite an array. I look every week, I look down their product line, and I see that the collections, the naval collections, Wings of Gold jackets, U.S. military issue, Top Gun collection, V-3 bomber jackets. Wow. Women's jackets, vintage leather jackets. They actually have the patterns given to them by the various military organizations that order jackets from them. Dale, why don't you tell us a little bit about when you visited U.S. Wings?
Well, I think the thing that I was most impressed with was the quality of the coats. And not just the coats, but the sweatshirts, the golf shirts, for lack of a better name, the nose art from the B-24, 25, B-17s, everything that they had displayed all around their store there.
They actually have the nose art, folks. If you're ever in Hudson, Ohio, by the way, it's right off the, is that Turnpike or Freeway?
Turnpike.
And it's at the Heinz Road exit. It's about a quarter mile off the Turnpike. They have the nose art from the Memphis Belle. Think about that, huh? They have the nose art from the I know, when I saw that, how did they get that? Whoa!
Well, we'll find out in a little bit when we have...
we have Bob Crudy on.
That's right. When I bring him on, we can talk about that. But I would strongly suggest, especially for presents of people that you're looking for military apparel, just go to uswings.com and you'll find pretty much everything that you would ever want.
Oh, that's...
High quality. High quality.
Don't even look anywhere else when you're buying something for that military man or woman. Start your Christmas shopping at U.S. Wings. That's U.S. Wings. You can get on the website info@uswings.com. That's info@uswings.com. Okay, Dale. Well, we're going to talk about, you know, hey, your microphone's still open there.
I know. We're just chuckling in here because you just gave out their email address. That's for information.
Oh,
you send
okay,
that
well, probably,
to info at...
Probably uswings.com. Then,
that's
right?
The place.
There we go.
Well, that's the place.
I have it highlighted here. uswings.com. And how about the Village Kitchen on Maple Road in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan?
Absolutely. The Village Kitchen Restaurant in the Maple Village Shopping Plaza on Maple Road on the west side of Ann Arbor. You come, you eat, you like, you come back.
And you come back. Helen, your host and the proprietor of the Village Kitchen, she makes sure that every day the food that comes out of that kitchen is, scrumptiously delicious. And I can vouch for that because I'm in there just about every week.
As am I. And she offers a 10% discount on your entire bill if you mention that you heard about it on Veterans Radio.
And or a vet. I'm hoping to have her have some Saganaki. Wouldn't that be nice? Opa, Saganaki. That's the Village Kitchen Restaurant on Maple Road in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Oh, yeah, that's some good old World War II music. You know, that band stuff was really a swinging. That was, if you can't tap your foot to that, boy, you're not alive. Mm-hmm. Well, on the program with me right now is Mr. Bob Crudy, the sales manager and marketing director for U.S. Wings. Bob, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good morning, guys. How you doing today?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's your Ohio State guys. Maybe doing something to the transmitter. We don't know. That can't be possible, right? How are you folks doing down here for the big game?
Well, you know, we really don't pay attention to that too much anymore.
Oh, no.
We have so much business we have to deal with in regards to our our jackets and everything.
Yeah, okay.
No, the game's on today, but we're busy selling our coats all over the world.
I was over at the restaurant this morning, and there was a lot of scarlet and gray. And
I'm sure there were.
That's okay. Bob, you have a connection to the B-29 bomber. How did that happen?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. Bob, you know me for a long time, and I'm sort of a history nut. And back in 2003, my niece met a young man while she was in the Air Force and became engaged. And it turned out that his grandfather was a retired colonel in the United States Air Force and was a B-29 pilot during World War II. He and I became very, very good friends, and we would correspond weekly, and I would ask him questions about specific missions and the aircraft and what it was like to be a pilot. And then every Sunday night we would usually call each other and we would talk further. And we became just great friends, even so far as he sent me copies of his personal flight logs that he made after each mission, starting on March 11th, 1945, all the way up to the end of July 1945.
Hold your thought right there. And, I have them right here in my hands, folks. And they are, what interesting, they're actually the notes of each mission that were handwritten. Oh, what? I mean, you could just go, Bob, why can't you put that on your website?
I'm going to look at it and see if we can. I have to figure out how we do that. But I have to thank Grandpa Hall's family. I call him Grandpa as a term of endearment because I've become very close with him and his family. And Grandma Minnie Mae still down there in Fort Worth, and his daughter Bev and son Jim the third, and my nephew Jimmy the fourth. You know, we've become obviously a family out of all these years, and Bev sent me copies of those logs a couple weeks ago that I passed on to you. And I think what it does, Bob, is it really puts a personal side to the comments that your first speaker talked about, which is more from a technical standpoint. When you read through his logs and he talks matter-of-factly what they went through on those missions, 14, 15, 16-hour missions, leaving Guam anywhere from 5:30 in the afternoon, flying to the island, getting there in the dark, having searchlights hitting, going through incendiary clouds that were so violent that they shook rivets out of the planes. I mean, it's just incredible to know what each one of our guys went through. And it really wasn't talked about a lot. I think, you know, most people know about the B-17s from the 12 o'clock high movies, and so much attention was always talked about the war in Europe. But what these guys did, the B-29 pilots did, they truly ended the Japanese war machine. And not most people know that, you know, there was a atomic bomb that went off in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, but the truth is the B-29s completely destroyed Japan, completely, even to the point where back in the late 90s, I had the opportunity to visit Tokyo, and I went to a tour around the city, and I walked to this one in particular very famous temple. And I was looking at my wife, and I said, boy, this thing must really be old. And I looked over, and there was a little sign there, and it said B-29s destroyed this 16-block area in 1945. Well, I asked Grandpa Hall about that later, and he said, well, where did you go? And I told him I went to this temple, and then we took this tour on the Seven Bridges, the River of the Seven Bridges. And he goes, Bobby, he says, you're not going to believe this. He said, but when we would have problems with our radar control or there was problems with the flights, we always used as a last resort to fly to the initial point of that Seven Rivers, and we'd fly up that river, and then we would either turn right or left and drop all of our bombs. And so I thought to myself, oh, my goodness, he probably leveled this area back in 1945. So, you know, it's just a complete effort through all the efforts through the World War II that our guys did that most people don't really know about what they went through.
That also begs the question, did we need to drop the atomic bomb on Japan? There were some thoughts that we could have dropped it on an island. Hey, look at this, and watch carefully. So give a little comment on that. What's your thoughts? I know that you're...
Well, I had a lot of conversations with Grandpa Hall about that. And quite honestly, he felt that it was necessary that if they would not have dropped those bombs, the incendiary bombing would have continued, and more importantly, the United States Army and Marines and Navy would have had to invade the island, and we would have lost millions, literally millions of our soldiers. And those bombs stopped the Japanese war machine and prevented a horrific killing, really, not only of our soldiers, but of the Japanese civilians, because they were prepared to fight to the last person to defend their homeland, as was witnessed in Okinawa, where there was just terrible, terrible civilian losses as well as military losses.
The warrior,
This
was the warrior. Fight to the end. Well,
yes.
As we heard from Bob Dorr, there were which I didn't know about. I didn't know about. Well, again, we were talking about Europe, and the newspapers and articles were all talking about Europe. Maybe that was because World War II was winding down in Europe, and of course people would be coming home. And we really didn't have any troops on the. We didn't have any boots on the ground in Japan. We had them in the air.
Yes, you know, a lot of people, they see pictures of the war over in Japan, and they see these formations of aircraft. Well, actually, there was two types of missions they flew. They flew night missions, which is about 60% of them, but 40% were daylight missions, in which they actually flew right over the city. And Grandpa Hall told me that he actually preferred the daylight missions as opposed to what the B-17s did in Europe. And the reason was that they flew actually in multiple ship formations. At nighttime, they went in single mission formations. And he said at nighttime, between the dark and the smoke and the thermals from the incendiary bombs.
Oh, yeah, the heat.
They were incredibly, incredibly difficult and dangerous. And once they were on their bombing run, they couldn't deviate. So they, no matter what the Japanese threw at them, they had to maintain that altitude in that direction until they dropped their bombs, at which time they would then peel off. Well, in the daytime, they had a little bit more room to maneuver, and they could tell what was around them, where at nighttime they really couldn't. I remember one time him telling me that one of the most terrifying things he ever heard, ever experienced, was one of his early night missions when they were coming over the city, and all of a sudden the searchlights went on. And he said the inside of the plane was like daylight, and they had to put their sunglasses on because they couldn't see the instruments. It was so bright. Well, then later on, and not too many people know this, but from about June on, they painted the bottom of all the B-29s black, and they had big black markings on the bottom to dull the effects of the searchlights, but you very rarely ever see photographs of those, you know, in any publications. But that was a fact from about June on. They were all painted black to try to stop that and hopefully prevent the radar-controlled guns from bringing them down.
One thing that I, when you and I were talking before we did the program, and you talked about, and I really want to cover this story because they needed airflow, the B-29s, they had radio engines, they needed airflow to keep them cool, and they had to get up to speed. Now, you told me about this, that what you saw on Guam, talk a little bit about that.
Well, at Guam, there was actually three different airfields. There was a depot airfield, and then there was the Northwest Airfield and then North Airfield. North Airfield today and Northwest Airfield are called Anderson Air Force Base on Guam, in which my daughter was stationed. But Grandpa Hall would explain the missions. Basically, there would be as many as 150 aircraft that would be their engines running, waiting to take off on this base. And at that time, the runway was around 8,500 feet long. And they had to... they had to exceed their gross weight in terms of takeoff speed. So, in other words, if they were taking off at 138,000 pounds, they had to exceed 138 miles an hour to lift the aircraft off the ground. And imagine them taking off of this tropical island where it's incredibly warm, 90 degrees plus, high humidity, and those engines are running. And they have to get every inch they can to get off that runway. And what they would do is they would keep their forward hatch open as their only escape route. And Grandpa Hall always told me that he always liked to rotate the nose of the aircraft at about 150 knots to give him, extra safety in terms of taking off. And there was times where he actually went past the end of the 8,500 feet, and then there was crushed coral from there to the end of the jungle. And he said his wheels would be literally inches off that crushed coral, and plumes of dust would be flying up into the aircraft. Because once they came off the end of it, there was a jungle, and it was 600 feet down to the water, at which point they would descend to the water to help get cool air to run those engines down. But he said there was times if a fellow lost an engine on takeoff, they wouldn't make it. They would crash into that jungle. Well, my daughter was stationed at Anderson in the security forces, and she told me when we were out there, took us out on the Hummer, and we drove out the end of the front flight line, and you could look down in that jungle and still see the aluminum parts of the fuselages and motors and things still these many, many, many years later. They just left them there. You know, it's sort of a testament to all those men that served on that island back in 1945.
Now, folks, think about this. These were four-engine, propeller-driven, heavy bombers, and the weight of the bombs was increased. They took off a lot of the defensive armament.
That's right.
To carry more bombs, so that meant they probably had to even, they were really pulling back and rotating on that stick.
Yeah, the aircraft was originally designed to be a maximum weight. I think it was around 124,000 pounds. And in Grandpa Hall's logs that I sent you, you can see where sometimes they flew, they took off as much as 138,000 pounds. And they eventually, near the end of his tour, they removed the rear 20-millimeter cannon just to save weight so they could utilize more bombs, which were primarily in center areas. And depending upon the load makeup, they used either 500-pound or 100-pound bombs. They could load up as max as a maximum number of bombs that they possibly could, and then fly again sometimes 12 to 16 hours there and back. Think about that today, to be in an aircraft that long, and you're not flying in a 747 with air conditioning. It's vibrating and making noise, and then you're all the adrenaline flowing from the mission. It was an incredible feat.
Exactly. I mean, and reading these logs, I can just see and feel what those fellows were going through. Somebody recently, as I was talking to them about the program that we're doing on a B-29, said it was a lot like the transition from the B-52 to the, what's that bomber, V-2, what do we have now?
The B-2. The new one.
B-2.
Right. Well, Grandpa Hall always, he flew every multi-engine aircraft that the Air Force had, starting with the B-17, B-24, B-29, B-36, B-47, and B-52. And he always told me that his favorite aircraft that he flew, including the modern-day Falcon jets, was the B-29. And the reason was that he had the same team members from his first mission to his last mission. And so they worked as a unit. And after World War II, that really never happened again. Guys would rotate in and out of various aircraft and depending on what the mission. But he had the same guys for all those missions. And so he knew exactly what they could do, what they were capable of. And he always attributed that one of the reasons for their success.
Now, let's get back to how advanced the B-29 was. The electronic fire,
right.
The electronic fire control system, the remote control gun turrets, that was all brand new stuff. And they actually had a computer.
They did. It was the first computer-controlled gun system in the United States Air Force, or Army Air Corps at that time. And basically they had, people are used to seeing pictures of the B-17 where guys have the guns sticking out of the waist gunners in the back and the turrets, they have their heads up. Well, the B-29, none of that happened. It was a completely pressurized aircraft, so all the turrets were sealed. But they had a command control center in the back of the aircraft, between the front of the aircraft, and then there was a tube that went through across the back of the bomb bay, and in the back were the rear gunners. And there was a dome on the top of which the commander could control all the guns simultaneously or divert the guns to the individual operators, whether they be in the nose or the sides or the tail. And that gun sort of looked like a camera that controlled it. It's hard to explain unless you really see it, but basically they would point the device at the aircraft, put in what kind of aircraft it was. It would calculate its speed and tell them how far to lead the aircraft in terms of trying to shoot it down. And they could point all the guns, as I said, at one direction. Grandpa Hall told me many times that the Japanese Zeros, as fast as they were, they couldn't catch a B-29. The B-29 was the fastest
aircraft at the time. The only way they could really attack them was head on. They would come right at them. And so that many times they would use the upper turrets and the lower turrets and point 850 caliber machine guns at them at the same time. And then as they would go by, then the guys in the back would pick up them as they came along the side there or towards the rear. But it was really an amazing system compared to anything that had existed at that time.
How effective was that in fighting the Zeros?
Very, very, very much so, because early in the war, until Iwo Jima was captured and they could use the P-51 Mustangs as air support, the B-29s had to protect themselves. And in fact, I think in his crew, if I go back through the logs, I think his crew, they shot down at least three Zeros during their tour, from March through July. I'd have to go back and check for sure, but I know he mentioned several times in there about several of those guys got a Zero or got a Tony or got whatever, and he talks about, how great that was.
Now, this was right after the B-29. Was there another bomber just before the jets came in?
Well, there was the B-36.
Turboprop or something?
Well, the B-36, which was even larger than the B-29, Grandpa Hall told me, he said, that was a handful. You had to use both hands to control the throttles because it had not only reciprocating engines or radial engines, but it also had jet engines. It had jet, I think it was four, two on each wing facing forward, and then it had six, radial engines facing rearward. And that was designed to be the next extension of the B-29 for flying from United States to Russia with the atomic bomb. But then jet age came in very quickly, and the MiGs were developed, and the B-36s became too slow. And that's when they went to the B-47s and eventually the B-52s that were, of course, much, much faster.
Well, I know I'm reading on the material that I have on the B-29 that the B-29 not only served in World War II, it also served in Korea.
That's correct.
Here's a little interesting story about the Russians. When there was a B-29 shot down, what happened, Bob?
Well, there was three of them that landed. They weren't actually shot down, but they landed in Manchuria, which was supposed to, on the way back from missions from to bomb Japan as an alternate safety route. And the Russians confiscated them, and they actually copied them identically. Every nut and bolt, every part of that aircraft that existed, they copied it. And if you read it through some various books, they actually show the factories in Russia, and they show the parts up on the wall of the U.S. version and the Russian version. And they kept that plane. They made it, but I forget what they called that plane. It was a Yak-50 or something like that. It was another example of the Russians copying something we did.
Yeah, right. There we go. However, these planes, and the most, I think, successful airplanes with the Air Force, came from the Boeing folks.
They did. You know, one of the things that Grandpa Hall told me, he was just such an interesting gentleman. I mean, I just truly enjoyed him, even the short time we knew each other. But I visited his home after he passed away, and on his walls in his apartment were all his various trophies and his medals and things that were precious to him from his Air Force career. But there was one plaque on there in particular that I thought was really great, and it was the control wheel cover plate from his B-29, which was called the City of Flatbush. And he told me, he said, all the 33 or 34 years I was in the Air Force, I never stole one thing except for that cover plate. When I got off my B-29 the last time, I took my penknife and popped that cover and I took it home.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And to see it on the wall, I mean, 40 years later, that just was so incredible.
Do you have that by any chance in your possession?
No, it's in Grandma Hall's apartment down in Fort Worth.
Well, we've got 2 minutes to go before the program is concluded. All right, Christmas time's coming up. We love to give you folks there at U.S. Wings as much airtime as possible. I've been down there. I've seen the quality of the material. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you're getting ready to do Santa's job?
Yeah, oh, wow. We were stocked and ready to go. We have a huge supply of the A2 flight jackets, which is the style that the United States Air Force wears. And we have a huge supply of the G1 jackets, which are the style that the United States Navy wears. The difference between them basically is the cut of the material. The Navy version has a mouton color. The Air Force One doesn't.
What's a mouton color? What is that?
It's a lamb type of material, soft material that the Navy guys needed to keep their ears warm, I guess.
Okay. Oh, yeah?
And we've been designated by the United States Navy. We made a special jacket you talked about earlier called the Wings of Gold, which is in honor of the Centennial of Navy Aviation, which is this year, 1911 to 2011. And we supply jackets to all of the military, to the United States Air Force, United States Coast Guard, United States Navy. But most importantly, we sell lots and lots of jackets to civilians. Many, many kids like to copy the jackets that their grandfathers or their uncles or their dads wore. And, the A2 jacket, or as people call them, the bomber jacket, is probably one of the best-selling jackets in the world and is well-known throughout the world for its durability. Today, they're mainly made out of goatskin, which is an incredibly strong, tough material. And you can find all the different products we have at our website, www.uswings.com.
Okay.
Or you can call us on our 800 number, 1-800-650-0659.
Thank you very much, Bob Crudy, Marketing Director at U.S. Wings. This is Veterans Radio, Bob Gould, saying goodbye. Until next week, you're dismissed.
The opinions expressed on Veterans Radio are not necessarily those of Veterans Radio or your local station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.